This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bill Kaufman has done a lot to revive the dying art of blacksmithing, and he says it's more than just making horseshoes.
We've got some people here that are real artists. I'm the guy that makes clevises and parts for plows and handrails and that sort of stuff, but we've got some people that can do stuff that is house jewelry.
Mary Cullen reports. Plus, John Norton talks with high school students still active in campaigning for gun law reform after the mass shooting in Florida. Eric Stock talks with hockey legend Bobby Hull. And we have analysis of the recent $250 million settlement in a lawsuit against State Farm Insurance. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Thanks for choosing this GLT podcast. While it's free to you, it's not free to produce. Take a moment and make a contribution to help pay for this program. Go to WGLT.org and thanks.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. State Farm Insurance recently agreed to pay $250 million to make litigation go away. It was a federal class action suit plaintiffs brought against the RICO Corrupt Practices Act, alleging State Farm conspired to fund the state Supreme Court campaign of Lloyd Carmire. Carmire did not recuse himself from a case once he won and was sworn in and broke a deadlock on the court in favor of State Farm. Illinois State University Politics and Government Professor Tom McClure studies corruption and influence and the courts, and joins us to consider the State Farm settlement. $250 million seems like a really large amount of money. Are there comparable settlements out there?
It doesn't seem like it would settle for nuisance value, does it? I'm unaware of any case that has had that large of a settlement when there's a claim that there's no basis for the litigation.
So what did you think of the briefs?
Well, there are some complicated legal issues that are raised, which I'm sure is why the plaintiffs wanted to settle the case, because it's unclear where some of the legal issues would go. On the other hand, I think that State Farm and the other defendants were very concerned about what would happen if this got to a jury, that it could be a runaway jury. And with the amount of money that was originally at stake, that was in excess of $1 billion, it could have been even more than that. So I think that that's why the case was settled.
Plus interest, plus other members of the class. There were some people talking about potentially $10 billion at stake here.
There was a question as to whether there was an entitlement to interest. On the other hand, there could be punitive damages, which could have exceeded whatever that interest would be anyhow.
Is this the course of the future, this kind of case, this big a case?
I don't know about that. I think that what happened here really emphasizes one of the big problems with having elected judges when there are campaign contributions. I believe that it inevitably creates the appearance of impropriety. And in this case, I think that what happened was if a jury had to decide it, I don't think a jury would be very sympathetic to a judge that received that kind of money.
You mentioned some complex legal issues. What were those?
Well, there's a statute of limitations issue. There was also an issue that had to do with whether antitrust doctrine applied here. Those kinds of issues were not really clear. There's another one in terms of when the actual predicate act under RICO became known. So, again, these are very complex legal issues that would be decided by the judge. It would never get to a jury.
Justice Sandra Day O'Connor had remarked earlier, some years ago, about this case, that it didn't look good. I'm paraphrasing. How often do we get judges accused of being picked and supported because they have a predilection as a pro-business judge or a pro-progressive cause judge?
I don't think that it's unusual that interest group money goes to judges that philosophically are in line with each other. I think that happens quite a bit. The issue is whether or not the circumstances here as to the timing and the amount of the contribution and the parties that were involved made a difference. The case that's somewhat analogous is a U.S. Supreme Court case called Caperton versus Macy Cole. And in that case, the United States Supreme Court found that a West Virginia Supreme Court justice who received over $3 million of independent contributions from the president of a defendant before them, that created an actual risk of bias, and the court found that was a due process violation and reversed the case. So this case is somewhat similar, although the amount of money isn't as much, but it's a very similar case factually. As far as the donations by interest groups, there's been a couple studies, nationwide studies, to contributions to the Supreme Court by Professors Kang and Shepard, which seems to at least establish a correlation with every dollar of contribution by an interest group that it changes the likelihood of the justice casting a vote in favor of that interest group.
Even though most judges try very hard to do their jobs and do them fairly, how does that tendency come in spite of their best efforts?
Well, this is the difficulty. In this case, Justice Carmeier took the position that he was not biased, and that's why he declined the opportunity to recuse himself. As far as we know, he was sincere in that belief. It was the same thing in the Caperton case at the U.S. Supreme Court. The judge specifically said that he did not have a bias. The problem is whether or not the facts are such that it creates this risk because the appearance seems so likely that there is a bias. And that's the problem. And there's been a split decision. That was one of these 5-4 cases of the U.S. Supreme Court with Justice Kennedy, with the four liberal justices, and the four conservative justices in the minority. So it's not a real easy case to decide. And I think it's the same thing in this State Farm case.
Well, if it were to go all the way, would Caperton be decided differently today, given the different makeup of the court?
I think it's established precedent. The Supreme Court has relied on Caperton in at least two instances, to my knowledge, since then. And in fact, the last one was a unanimous decision, so I think it's well-established precedent. It's not going to be reconsidered at this stage.
So it was an $8 million campaign. Justice Carmeier's coffers were supported to the tune of at least $3 million, and perhaps more than that, by entities that had State Farm involvement on their boards. Is that enough to connect the dots? State Farm would argue that these independent organizations such as the Illinois Business Roundtable and the Civil Justice League and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce all put down markers on Carmeier because he was known to be separately a pro-business judge, and that there's no collusion, no State Farm involvement. Do you think there are dots to connect there?
That's why there's a lawsuit. I think arguments can be made on either side. And when this case came up for direct appeal, the United States Supreme Court declined to accept it. There was later a petition that was filed to reopen it because of the newly discovered evidence. And again, the U.S. Supreme Court declined to accept it. So I don't know that it was absolutely clear that that was the case. You would have to connect the dots. But if you take a look at the counsel who represented both sides here, you have some of the top attorneys, litigation attorneys in Illinois. As a matter of fact, you even have some people from outside of Illinois who are participating in these briefs. So this would have been an excellent trial to see, and I think both sides would have given the best representations possible. All in all, what would an Illinois jury do on this down in the southern part of the state near St. Louis? They probably would be pro-plaintiff. I suspect that they probably would rule in favor of the plaintiffs. I think the biggest problem the plaintiffs had were how the legal issues were going to go and whether the case would even get to a jury.
We have Caperton. We have this, which is now settled. Are more of these cases going to come up as big money becomes more common? The Carmeier campaign at the time was notable because of the large amount of money, but it's become less notable in the entire scheme of things since then. Are we going to see more cases like this?
The amount of money that's been contributed to state Supreme Court campaigns has increased dramatically since before Citizens United. And my belief is that it probably has increased even more after Citizens United. So I think the potential of these cases will continue.
Have recusals and requests for judges to recuse themselves also increased as a result of big money going into judicial campaigns?
Different states operate differently on this. There are some states that require recusal if a certain amount of money is donated to a judge. For instance, in New York State, a donation of more than $2,500 automatically keeps that judge from hearing a case. So if an attorney donates that kind of money, or a party does, they don't hear the case. In Utah, it's $50, and the judge doesn't hear the case. So,
that seems a little out of scale the other way.
Well, those folks in Utah, they don't want to have any appearance of corruption, apparently. But in Illinois, we had a State Bar Association committee look at whether there should be limits. And the conclusion of the committee, which was accepted by the Supreme Court, was that each judge should be able to decide for him or herself whether or not the amount of money is inappropriate, and there's not going to be any categorical rule in Illinois. As a matter of fact, one of the things the committee said is that there could be gamesmanship, and that what will happen is lawyers and parties who don't want to have a particular judge will donate money to that judge so that they don't have that judge decide their case.
Is this something the Illinois General Assembly would ever tackle?
In terms of campaign finance?
Yeah.
My suspicion is that there is a limit on the amount of money that could be contributed overall to a judge's campaign that would run into First Amendment issues, Citizens United-type issues. We do have limitations as to how much individuals can contribute, but a lot of this comes from interest groups or soft money, so Citizens United prevents that. So I don't think the General Assembly could control that.
You said earlier this is a problem inherent to the election of judges. So if judges are not to be elected, how should we choose them?
Well, I think that one way of doing it would be through merit selection. They have merit commissions. That approach is used in a number of states. That's the original Missouri plan. And that takes away the problem of money and the judiciary. Now, it may create other political questions. Any process of selecting a judge is going to be political, but I think the public has a bigger problem with the money that's involved. And although the general public would prefer to elect judges, the general public doesn't want to have all this money involved in judicial decision-making. So I think the only solution is probably to get rid of the election of judges.
Why is money a bigger problem than the scenario of the legendary smoke-filled room where you're also selecting judges on a political basis with an ideological bent or an interest bent, and they know to whom they are beholden for their selection?
I don't think the problem is ideological bent. I think that the voters like the opportunity to be able to choose judges who they can identify with, either by party or by their ideology. I think the problem is they don't want to have the judges bought and sold. I think that's what the concern is. There's a big difference between a judge ruling consistently in a conservative way or a liberal way than a judge who rules a specific way in a particular case because of the amount of money that the judge received.
What are other methods of merit selection that could be used?
Well, this isn't necessarily a merit selection, but some states have experimented with public financing of judicial campaigns. That was done in Wisconsin, and that was done in North Carolina. As it turned out, both legislatures eliminated that selection mechanism. The problem is it costs money to fund these campaigns, and the General Assemblies in both of these states decided that it wasn't worth that. Another idea that's been floated, it was floated locally in the Miami area, in Dade County, Florida, as well as in Detroit, of having anonymous donations to judges using a trust fund as a way of disseminating the money. Both of those experiments failed. In fact, one wasn't even launched. And the problem is, I think that the reformers were somewhat naive. They thought that lawyers would just give money to judges but not have any recognition, when the reality is, if you're going to give money, you want to make sure that the judge knows that you're supporting the judge.
Tom McClure is a professor of politics and government at Illinois State University. This is 89.1 and WGLT.org. This is the final week of the fall fund drive. We fell short of the first week's dollar goal, so we're working extra hard right now to catch up. That's why we're reminding you once again that local support, including your contribution, makes up GLT's largest and most reliable source of income. It's the money we must have to be able to pay for the programs you rely on. Every contribution, no matter what the amount, helps pay for Sound Ideas and everything else you expect from GLT and NPR. Contribute whatever you can right now at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Luther Oaks, presenting From the Kitchen to the Courts, a lifelong learning series complimentary for guests 62 or older. Thursday, October 25th, 1:30 to 3:30 at ISU's Alumni Center. RSVP by October 18th. Details at lutheroaks.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, hockey legend Bobby Hull visits with Eric Stock. Student protests following the Valentine's Day mass shooting in Parkland, Florida, have not ebbed in the months since then. A Twin Cities youth group formed to advocate for gun reform will hold a town hall October 12th with local politicians and candidates. Bloomington Normal Youth Activists is comprised of students from high school and middle school from Bloomington Normal. Members Allie Beam, Ellie Diggins, and Gavin Cunningham stopped by the GLT studios to talk with John Norton about the event to be held at the McLean County Museum of History. Beam says though the town hall is open to the public, the format allows students to have a voice in political matters, specifically for the upcoming midterms.
Right. Students are the future. Students are our future voters. So it's really important to make sure that everyone's informed now, so in a couple years when we're voting, we know what we are voting for.
Okay. Gavin, what kind of questions are you hoping to ask and maybe get answered?
So some of the questions that we are looking to ask will involve different issues going on currently in our political atmosphere. We have certain questions about different kinds of issues such as gun control, especially of what's going on in town over the past year. But we really want people to ask questions that they care about, of things that they want to know from their representatives or the people that want to become their representatives.
How engaged are young people? Has it been the Parkland shooting that got young people engaged in politics specifically? I mean, in general, as opposed to just gun control?
That was definitely a big hand in why many young people are getting involved in politics. They see that there are a group of students down in Parkland that were able to make national headlines and start basically some sort of revolution on gun control because of what happened there. So students are realizing that we have a voice and that people will listen to us if we make that voice heard.
How many kids? Is it just like a really small number of kids in these schools that are starting to be more engaged like you guys, or has it spread a little bit wider than that?
As you probably know, we had the walkouts last year. And between Weston Community, I think we had over 500 students, as well as U-High had...
We had several hundred.
Yeah. So we have hundreds of students that are walking out on an issue that they care passionately about. And I think that that is only a small glimpse of students in our community that feel like they want to be politically active and want to make a change.
So what kind of reaction, I'll go to you, Ellie, what kind of reaction are you seeing from older people that maybe you guys are too young to be involved in this?
I was one of the main organizers for the Kingsley walkout back in March, and I actually received a lot of support from parents and some of my teachers, too. But I also received some backlash on how they felt like I was being too involved and too, like, brainwashed.
Who was giving you some of that backlash? You don't have to name names. The types of, were there teachers or parents or were there online? Were people giving you grief?
Mostly people online, and some of my friends' parents are giving me some backlash, but we didn't really listen to them and continue to protest.
You know, I want to go to the gun control. Anybody can address this. I was, as a parent of a now 21-year-old who went to Bloomington High School, who didn't tell me a whole lot what was going on in school, which is very typical of students, right? I had no idea all these drills were going on with shooting, you know, preparedness. When especially Parkland happened, or maybe it was before that, how scary is this for you guys? I mean, is this a very visceral thing, like on a day-to-day basis for you guys?
Absolutely. Speaking on behalf of many students in our country, I think this is an issue that we have to deal with daily because nobody at Parkland expected that it would be them. And so now we have to be aware that this is a real possibility for all of us and that we need to be able to take all the precautions necessary to ensure that this is not happening anymore.
That's Allie Bean from U-High. Also in studio is Gavin Cunningham and Ellie Diggins, both from Normal West, all three part of the group BN Youth Activists who are staging a town hall. That'll be October 12th at the McLean County Museum of History. I'm John Norton. This is GLT's Sound Ideas. I want to go back to the town hall. Gavin, I'll go back to you. Is this just for students, or are you hoping the community at large is a part of this?
No, so we are hoping to get all different people from the community involved. We have registration on our website, www.bnactivist.com. Just because we do have limited seating, we have a certain amount of tickets set aside for only students just to make sure that students who want to go get the opportunity. But we are definitely hoping and, of course, welcoming to anyone else who is wanting to go.
Who is doing the moderating?
That will be members of our group doing the moderating for this event.
Okay. And Ellie, I mean, are you looking for questions from the people who attend? And are you looking for specifically students to be asking these questions?
We're looking for people of all ages to be asking these questions. Audience members who are at the event can ask them, and we'll also be taking online questions.
Okay, I want to go back to what Ellie said about getting backlash, and it sounded like it was mostly online, and getting backlash for your activism. Ellie, why is it important for people and politicians to listen to young people who can't even vote yet?
I think it's really important to listen because the country that is being created right now is the one that we are going to be raised in. It's the one that's going to be our future and we're going to raise our kids in. So it's really important that we are involved in it as well as everyone who is allowed to vote because this is our future. These are our lives as well.
Gavin, I'll go back to you. You've had politicians accept they will be there answering questions. Who are some of these people?
So right now we have confirmations from Mayor Coos, Ben Webb, Jill Blair. We have a representative from the Betsy Dirksen Longdrigan campaign as she is going to be at a different event that night. And we also have Shina Wachinski, who is running for McLean County Board, as well as we are pretty sure about Dan Brady's attendance.
We're still waiting on his final confirmation, but we're hoping.
Okay, so there's a slight mix of Democrats and Republicans in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, we're still working with other people and talking. This is in no way a final list.
Are you hoping to convert some of this town hall and what happens there into some educational efforts or lobbying efforts?
I think absolutely. Education is one of our main priorities, making sure that people are engaged in going out to the polls and voting.
When you guys started with gun control in Parkland, and now you're branching out to other ideas, what clicked in your mind about, geez, I wish I would have been paying attention to this, or maybe I wish parents or my teachers or whatever would have tried to get us more engaged earlier, or maybe they have, and it finally clicked?
Columbine happened in 1999. None of us were alive then. This has been going on our entire lives, and this is something that we've seen, we've heard in the news. But we didn't think that we could actually have an impact until we saw what happened at Parkland.
And what makes you think you're actually having an impact?
When more people are listening to us, more people are starting dialogues. We've seen that just from our own community. People are willing to talk to people that maybe don't always agree on different political issues, but see that, I mean, things like bump stocks. People are agreeing from both sides that bump stocks should just be illegal because they can turn a gun into a semi-automatic weapon.
We're talking with Gavin Cunningham from Normal Community West, Allie Bean from U-High, and Ellie Diggins, also from Normal West, Bloomington Normal Youth Activists, and they're having a town hall October 12th at the McLean County Museum of History. Is what you're doing, Bloomington Normal Youth Activists, is it considered a progressive or democratic group, or is it nonpartisan?
It is nonpartisan, and that is our goal, is to make everything as straightforward and allowing people to be able to see both sides of any issue.
So do you have more conservative members in Bloomington Normal Youth Activists right now?
Currently, we have not had a huge amount of conservative members ask to join our group, but we are certainly incredibly open and looking forward to including members not only conservative versus liberal, but also libertarian or socialist people who want to be a part of it.
You know, and that's an interesting point. And Gavin, Ellie, I'm not ignoring you, so if you want to dive in. But Gavin, you mentioned something about 1999 when Columbine happened. You guys weren't even alive yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly remember that, but I grew up in basically the 70s. And even then, you work hard and you will get somewhere out of that. You guys are in a whole different thing. I mean, socialism is not a dirty word with young people. Capitalism, it, to some people, has become a dirty word. It's like the world is flipped upside down from 30, 40 years ago. Do you still feel like I did in the early to mid-70s that I can grow up and do anything I want?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like we have a lot of agency, and we feel like we can go and do a lot of different things in our world today.
But universities cost a lot more money, right?
That's true.
Yeah. Jobs, you don't just get out of school and get a $20 an hour manufacturing job. These are the kind of things I'm saying. It's like you didn't want to go to school, you're fine. You could get a job, you know, a blue-collar job that made really good union wages.
Right, and of course it's, difficult. We have to be making these decisions, deciding what colleges are worth it for us now, considering prices or what jobs we want to do. But once we are able to decide kind of what we're interested in, it does still feel like we can still achieve.
Yeah, but I'll finish with you. I don't want to be a pessimist, but I mean, I'm going back to when I grew up and you guys are very engaged. I'm guessing you're, you know, the bright sparks of your classes at your schools as well. Do the kids who aren't at the level you're at, do they have these same opportunities, you guys? And I'm going back to the whole conversation we had a couple of years ago, why Donald Trump got elected, right? That there's all these people, we're talking older people now, that just kind of feel neglected, kind of feel like they're not a part of the American dream anymore. Do you see kids your age have that same kind of attitude?
I think that there are definitely still people that feel that way already, but I really do believe that every single person can be an important member of our society and how our government works because of the way it is set up.
Yeah, and sometimes there are factors, obviously, outside that are keeping people from being able to achieve these same types of things. But on a grand scheme, we're all trying to aid people who aren't given the same opportunities. And so maybe not at first. Maybe people aren't. Everyone's not obviously on the same level from because of outside factors. But I think that with this generation, we can work, and I'm optimistic that we can help everyone to be able to achieve what they want to do.
That's U High senior Allie Beam, along with NCHS senior Gavin Cunningham and freshman Ellie Diggins, speaking with GLT's John Norton. The three are members of BN Youth Activists, a Twin Cities student-led organization, holding a town hall for local politicians and candidates October 12th at the McLean County Museum of History. The event begins at 7 p.m.
Budu, host of The 21st. I'm a relative newcomer to GLT. We just joined the lineup a few years ago. Maybe you're relatively new to GLT as well, but you've come to depend on the in-depth reporting, the thoughtful conversations, and the deep dives into culture you can't find anywhere else. You should know that WGLT and The 21st don't have income from advertising to pay our programming bills. Instead, we rely on people like you, but it only works if everyone helps. Make your first-time contribution at WGLT.org.
Contribute $10 a month to support GLT, and you'll hear it working for you all year long. Every day, no matter what program you've tuned into, you'll know your contribution is helping make it happen. It's a budget-friendly way to support your public radio station, and it makes a real difference for GLT. It takes just a minute to set it up at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from the Community Cancer Center, proud to provide community-based cancer care with the help of more than 100 volunteers, many of whom are cancer survivors who are well-equipped to support patients. Information at cancercenter.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, Mary Cullen reports on the restoration of a dying art, blacksmithing. Bobby Hull is considered one of the best ever to play hockey. He spent a majority of his 23 seasons in professional hockey with the Chicago Blackhawks, where he was one of the National Hockey League's iconic players and helped lead the Blackhawks to a Stanley Cup title in 1961. Now at age 79, Hull remains an ambassador for the Blackhawks. He also does various speaking engagements, including one in Bloomington next week. He's the keynote speaker for the Bloomington Normal YMCA's annual Legacy Dinner on October 11th. Hull tells GLT's Eric Stock the Y reached out to him to help pitch its multi-million-dollar fundraising campaign to build a new facility in Bloomington.
I've known Bob Dubsky and his family for a number of years. And he's always been great to us anytime we ever wanted to come in his area. And I understand that he is heading up this fundraiser for the YMCA. And as a kid, I went to the Y, did a lot of swimming and calisthenics, and decided that I wanted to help Bob out. And it's just snowballing.
Yeah, Bob Dobsky from the local McDonald's franchises that he owned and operated, he and his wife, Julie Dobsky, for many years. So tell me about your YMCA experience growing up, and where was this?
This was in Belleville, Ontario, Canada. I lived about 7 miles from Belleville, and lots of times I'd be after a hockey game on a Saturday morning or Thursday evening, I'd be stuck for a while until I could get a ride home, and I'd always visit the Y's and spend some time swimming and exercising while I was waiting for my ride.
We always think of you as a hockey legend, but you were a multi-sport athlete when you were young, it sounds like.
Yes, I played baseball, I played football. The only sport that didn't come in our area would be lacrosse, and I always look back on that thinking I would love to have played lacrosse. That was my kind of game, rough and tough, and had to be in great condition to be able to play it. But we never ever came to our area. But all the other sports, baseball, fastball, football, tennis, you name it, I gave it a try.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock. We're talking with Bobby Hull, the hockey legend who is coming to Bloomington for the YMCA Legacy Dinner on October 11th. Now, you wore number 9 as a tribute to your childhood idol, Gordie Howe, and hockey fans know all about the so-called Gordie Howe hat trick, a goal, an assist, and a fight. Now, today, it seems the league has tried to legislate fighting out of the game, and it's come to the point where the so-called enforcer, who really does little else but rough up the other team's primary scores, hardly exists anymore. What do you think that's done for the sport?
I really don't know. My opinion is that hockey is played in an inclined in a small area, around 200 by 85, and guys run into one another quite often during the game. And some guys are more hot-tempered than others. And after 2 or 3 whacks at one another, they're going to drop the gloves and throw a few punches. I don't think that's wrong with the game. But these coaches that send people out there just to get the better players off their game and prevent them from entertaining the people, that's not necessary. And I don't condone the fighting. I don't condone these goofballs that can't play the game properly. But I do not think that fighting should be taken out of the game.
It does seem the National Hockey League has tried to renew emphasis on player safety. Has the league done enough to help the retired players with their health care after they walk away from such a physical sport that they play for so many years?
I would like to think that they were trying to help we older players. There are several players that gave upwards of 20 years to the National Hockey League and now have nothing to show for it. And those are the people that some of these people making $8 and $10 million a year maybe should think about providing them with some funds so that they are not only existing, but they have a decent form of life after the game.
Now, you played for more than 20 years. How has that process been like for you after your playing days ended?
I was ready to retire. As a matter of fact, they talked me into coming back when I shouldn't have. 77-78 was my last full season that I was any good, and I retired for a year, and then they talked me into coming back, which I should never have, but I did, and that's water over the dam, and it never hurt me any. I was ready to retire and ready to go ahead with a different part of my life.
Well, you come from a hockey family. Your younger brother, Dennis, played in the NHL with you. Your children are all athletic. We're most familiar with Brett Hull, another one of the NHL all-time greats. As you prepare for the YMCA's legacy dinner, what is your family's legacy?
Oh, God, I just hope that when people ask me, Bobby, what would you like to be known for after your 23 years of professional hockey? And I would like to be known as an entertainer. Early in my career, I knew that hockey was a sport that the better you entertained your fans, the stronger your franchise was. And I tried every game that I played to entertain those 22,000 people in the stands. And I hope that after those 23 years that people will remember me as a player that gave it all every game and entertained the fans royally game after game.
As we continue with hockey legend Bobby Hull here on Sound Ideas, the Blackhawks, who you've been an ambassador for many years, missed the playoffs this past season after a dynasty-type run, three Stanley Cup titles in six seasons from 2010 to 2015. Their stars are getting older. Jonathan Toews is 30. Patrick Kane is 29. The NHL salary cap has forced the team to part with a number of key players. Has the Blackhawks' championship window closed?
I don't know whether we'll ever see. I'll be 80 in January. I don't know whether I'll ever see another Stanley Cup come to the Blackhawks. It's going to depend on how some of these young players mature and how well our management drafts and scouts the players. I certainly hope that they'll be in the playoffs for the next few years, and then we can decide after that whether they have a chance to bring another Stanley Cup to the well-deserved Chicago fans.
And lastly, as you prepare for your speaking engagement in Bloomington, your audience will be largely community leaders, those who support the YMCA, youth athletics, and activities in this community. So some of them, I suspect, will be there just to meet one of their favorite hockey players of all time. So what will your message be for them?
Hockey has been my life, and what they're going to hear out of my mouth is some of my experiences, and mostly all about the game of hockey and some of the anecdotes that have come my way during my 23 years of professional hockey.
Hull will be the keynote speaker at the Bloomington Normal YMCA Legacy Dinner on October 11th at the Doubletree Hotel and Conference Center in Bloomington. Bobby Hull spoke with GLT's Eric Stock. Proceeds from the dinner will benefit youth programming and subsidized memberships at the Y.
This is Bloomington Normal's Public Media. You've probably been thinking about making a contribution to help pay for the GLT and NPR programs you value. You know GLT depends on listeners' financial support to pay the bills. You know you depend on GLT for fact-based news you can trust and entertainment you actually look forward to. Heads up, we're into the last week of the fall fund drive, and we're running short of making the fund drive goal. That means it's time to stop thinking about supporting GLT and actually do it. Don't put it off any longer. Help reach this week's goal. Give what you can to help pay for the programs you depend on, like Sound Ideas. Become a GLT contributor now at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is Sound Ideas. From medieval weapons to farming tools to hand railings and wall hangings, blacksmithing is actually thought to have started around 1500 BC in the Middle East. By the Middle Ages, it had grown into a highly respected craft. Then, as the Industrial Revolution gave way to factories, communities needed blacksmiths only as farriers to shoe horses and repair equipment. After the automobile, society didn't need them much at all. Today, there's a small resurgence in the craft. GLT's Mary Cullen talks with Illinois blacksmiths determined to bring attention to their art.
On a hot, late summer day at the Funks Grove Nature Preserve, Bill Kaufman pounds his hammer hard, casting sparks around the circle where wide-eyed students watch a glowing metal block slowly beat over an anvil. Nearly 50 years ago, Kaufman joined a group of 20 to start a blacksmithing class in central Illinois.
When I was just a little kid, my dad used to take plowshares to a guy out on Route 9, and I was standing there watching him work when I was a little bitty guy and just making noise and getting dirty and fire, and it's always fascinated me. And so a number of years later, I dug out an old forge and stuff and started playing with it.
Kaufman says his forge only got him so far. At that point, most trade blacksmiths were either dead, unable, or unwilling to take him as an apprentice. His search for knowledge led him to find others like himself, curious to bring back the craft. That group later formed the Sugar Grove Blacksmithing Class, which grew into the Illinois Valley Blacksmithing Association, or the IVBA.
And that's why the club got started, so other people could share the knowledge. And we found a guy in Eureka that was very helpful, kind of helped get the rudiments of blacksmithing spread around, and it just kind of took off from there.
Today, that club holds around 450 members. Kaufman says that's a lot compared to the National Club, which has 4,000 members. The IVBA meets in Sugar Grove every third Saturday of the month, and once a year, they host a class. IVBA members serve as instructors, showing blacksmithing novices the ropes, how to man the forge, and proper techniques for heating and hammering the metal. When it comes to hammering, precision is important. Hitting too hard or in the wrong spot could change the project entirely. But not hitting hard enough won't give good results either. It's a balance between getting the metal hot enough to shape it and hitting it accurately and with enough force. Kaufman says he works a lot with iron, which is typically forged anywhere between 1200 degrees and 2500 degrees Fahrenheit. If your forge is too hot, you run the risk of cracking your metal.
It's amazing to see the work that some of these people do. The work that I do is more utilitarian. We've got some people here that are real artists. I'm the guy that makes clevises and parts for plows and handrails and that sort of stuff, but we've got some people that can do stuff that is house jewelry.
One of those more creative artists is Victoria Schertz.
She does some of the prettiest work you've ever seen in your life.
He's a flatterer. I've been doing this for like 20 years. I have different orders all the time. I make lamps, I make tables, I make railings, I make chandeliers, I've made all kinds of indoor and outdoor furniture, gadgets, brackets.
Schertz owns a blacksmith shop in Tiscola, Illinois, where she gets all kinds of custom orders. She says she likes to combine metals in her work, creating a contrast between opposing colors and opposing shines.
If you can picture a sun done in a spiral. So you start out with the inside of the spiral done in steel, and it's kind of silver looking and has different shades. And then you do another spiral either on top or underneath it in the copper. and polish it up. So now you have two different metals together that would make a nice wall hanging.
After 20 years, she can't pick a favorite piece of work, but she does have a favorite metal. Copper.
It's softer, it moves, it speaks to me. Well, you can make a really nice copper bowl, and you can turn it all kinds of different colors and sheens and patinas. And if you make a really nice iron bowl, it's an iron bowl. I don't know.
She says it's just easier to work with.
Copper, you heat it up and then you quench it so it's cold, and then you can hold it with your hands while you're reshaping it. So it's a little different medium.
After working a piece of metal, a student scrapes away the remnant coal and castaway pieces of iron from the anvil. He has to prepare the area while the iron soaks up heat buried deep in the coals of the forge. Every time she works with blacksmithing students, Schertz says it reminds her of where she started.
You know, you just got to try it. And if you don't like it, and if it's too much for you and you just want to do something else, then move on. But at least you tried it and you know, you give it a shot. And that's what I did. I tried it. And I hated it, and I kept going. I don't know what made me keep going, but I had to conquer it, I guess.
Schertz, Kaufman, and the rest of the IVBA members at the Sugar Grove Forge are proud of the work they do and the resurgence of blacksmithing as a craft in the 21st century. It's why they love teaching youngsters, like 18-year-old Seth Homan, who began novice blacksmithing when he was 12.
The first thing I did was blow it up by mistake because I did not learn very quickly that propane doesn't work very well. But I quickly learned how to assemble old house bricks into a forge. And then from there, my forge grew hotter. And as it grew hotter, the bricks didn't work. And so I had to upgrade to better bricks. And from there, it was just a learning process until I finally got to a position where now my forge gets so hot, I literally have to have it underground in order to keep it in one piece.
Homan's initial forge worked for a while, but if the forge gets too hot and the bricks that build it weren't fired hot enough when they were made, it causes them to crack and crumble. A coal forge only needs a few things: a solid environment for heat to grow, a bellows to circulate air, a bed of coal to foster the fire, and a tweer to carry the air to the flame. Homan's starter forge wasn't exactly what one would call traditional.
Having an underground forge made out of house bricks and fire bricks and cinder blocks and a leaf blower, very retro, but it gets the thing done. I've melted more steel than I think I've crafted properly, so being here allows me to learn the proper techniques that I need that I wasn't able to learn.
Homan says the materials are one of the most important aspects of safe blacksmithing, such as good grade coal and steel.
Always is the best stuff you want. You don't want the stuff that'll blow up. That's a bad idea. They have good quality tools, hammers, chisels, picks. Anvils, for example, those are hard to find.
Homan says he is thankful for the opportunity to learn alongside professionals. It gives him the ability to bring those skills back home to teach others in his hometown.
I came here to learn, to make sure that I could do it properly, because if I'm going to have a bunch of people out at my house who want to do this, I need to know what I'm doing first. And that is one of the more important things, is having the proper education. And this is a place that I know that you can get it.
Back in Waverly, Homan has a group of friends who enjoy using his underground forge.
We melt aluminum now. We take cookie sheets or little cupcake pans and fill them with molten aluminum, make little aluminum cupcakes. We do a whole bunch of random things. But now I get to come home and boast and be like, I've been to a professional grade blacksmithing class. You guys don't know what you're doing.
To melt aluminum, Homan's forge has to reach at least 1,221 degrees Fahrenheit. Watching a smith in action begs the question, how does that arm feel? There's a range of techniques for thinning, bending, widening, and puncturing the metal. But one thing remains constant: the blacksmith's need for a hammer. Schertz says blacksmithing requires a red-hot fire and a steady hand.
You heat up steel and you work it hot. So you have to hold it with tongs and hit it with a hammer while it's hot, and you have to continuously heat it back up.
It's no wonder blacksmithing draws a crowd. There's the clang of metal, the crackling of the forge, and sparks in all directions. Kaufman holds a demonstration every year at the Pontiac Threshermen's Reunion.
You stand there and a lady will come and kind of stand off to the side and watch you, and after everybody kind of leaves, the people come in waves and they leave, and she came up to me and she said, You know, I remember turning the crank for my father, and you could see the memory floating in front of her eyes. It was kind of a neat moment, and kind of that's what makes it fun.
When it comes to IVBA's Sugar Grove classes, the Iron Age craft draws in all ages.
We have a lot of interest in younger people. A lot of people kind of like to get their hands dirty. Some of them are involved in the arts. Some of them are not. They're just curious as to what's going on. And blacksmithing is perfect for young guys. You get dirty, you get to play in the fire, and you get to make a lot of noise. And when you get done, you might have something to show for it, besides the burn on your finger.
Working in the forge reminds Kaufman of the past, but he says seeing today's kids' interest in the craft shows that blacksmithing has a place in the future.
Since I'm one of the guys that kind of started some of this monkey business, I think I'm kind of proud of it. And we've rescued a craft that was kind of headed downhill, but it's alive and well in this area.
IVBA holds their annual class the third week of September, but the forge is open to visitors year-round at the Sugar Grove Nature Center. I'm Mary Cullen.
Find more information about the IVBA and the Sugar Grove Forge can be found on the Sugar Grove Nature Center website. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal. Our website is where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Mary Cullen, John Norton, and Eric Stock. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe to the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. And if you haven't noticed, this is week two of the GLT Fund Drive. Our goal is to raise the support needed to keep giving you the programs that you listen to on GLT. Please pledge at WGLT.org. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.